Good evening. We continue tonight with the Ascending Series of Substance, which is the 26th chapter in the Life Divine. We're roughly midway through the chapter. This was first seen in September of 1916, on the 15th of the month. Sri Aurobindo has lightly revised it. Here and there he has inserted important new sentences upon the revision to make his meaning more clear and to establish context, and we'll draw attention to a couple of those places tonight as we go through the balance of the chapter. So far, he has established that there is an ascending scale of being from the denseness of matter to the subtle freedom of the spirit. What typically distinguishes matter is its tangibility. It's touchable. It's resistance. It wants to hold its form. But substance does not exist only at the level of matter. Substance is the interrelationship between being and its own conscious force. And so where we arrive at a density of substance, we also arrive at a resistance, which is the resistance to the consciousness force by the substance through the sense, which is the intermediary of the two. And through that sense, the substance, the form, becomes the object of the witnessing consciousness. So at the level of matter, that form tends to be rigid. As we go higher and higher in the series, we'll see that that rigidity yields. Sri Aurobindo, in the last paragraph that we covered last week, arrived at this idea that physical laws are not final, that, in fact, they are subject to change by conscious will. And, in fact, all the universe is a manifestation of that conscious will. It has a teleological purpose in manifesting the apparent density and insentience of matter. It is not an accident. It is not something that has happened to, unwillingly, the divine being, but rather the divine being has invested itself in this poise with a purpose in mind. Telos, again, with an end or a purpose. Logos, discourse. So it's the doctrine of the final cause. There's a final purpose in the universe which the divine intends, coming from the immensity, the infinity of its own being, its unerring conscious power, its capacity to always derive perfect delight from experience, means that even though this is a serried evolution, that the culminating phase of the cosmic manifestation must result in the complete manifestation of that Satchit Ananda in whatever form it has chosen to take in this particular place in matter. So he's talked about matter here. Cosmic limits that we experience are deliberately determined then. So, having spoken about matter, he's now ready to proceed up the ascending series. In the next grade of substance, the initial dominating determining fact is no longer substantial form and force, but life and conscious desire. Therefore, the world beyond this material plane must be a world based upon a conscious cosmic vital energy. a force of vital seeking and a force of desire and their self-expression, and not upon an inconscient or subconscient will taking the form of a material force and energy. So in the plane of life, this must be a basis of its own self. It must have its own characteristic play in its own plane. And it's based upon this energy, this unrelenting power, vital seeking, force of desire, the things which are characteristic of vitality. It will not be subject in the same way to its form that matter was. It will not become insentient or inconscient. He continues, all the forms, bodies, forces, life movements, sense movements, thought movements, developments, culminations, self-fulfillments of that world must be dominated and determined by this initial fact of conscious life to which matter and mind must subject themselves, must start from that, base themselves upon that, be limited or enlarged by its laws, powers, capacities, limitations. And if mind there seeks to develop yet higher possibilities, still it must then, too, take account of the original vital formula of desire force, its purpose, and its demand upon the divine manifestation. So not only must form be obedient to the power of life in the realm of prana, but mind, too, must bend itself to the pranic intent. Prana, in this world, delimits what matter and mind can and would do. Prana, again, is the Sanskrit term for what is a great power, not simply life, but it is the power of existence. You might say how conscious force manifests itself in the cosmos we know and experience. He continues, so too with the higher gradations. The next in the series must be governed by the dominating and determining factor of mind. So just as matter has its own determinations, things must be in accordance with matter's laws if they want to manifest there, and life and mind have to subject themselves to those laws. And in the level of life, matter as form in the life plane and mind manifesting whatever lucidities it has have both to cohere with the intent of life. So too, in the realm of mind, mind will dictate to both form and power what limits they shall have. Substance there, he writes, must be subtle and flexible enough to assume the shapes directly imposed upon it by mind, to obey its operations, to subordinate itself to its demand for self-expression and self-fulfillment. The relations of sense and substance, too, must have a corresponding subtlety and flexibility, and must be determined not by the relations of physical organ with physical object, but of mind with the subtler substance upon which it works. The life of such a world would be the servant of mind, in a sense of which our weak mental operations and our limited coarse and rebellious vital faculties can have no adequate conception. There, mind dominates as the original formula. Its purpose prevails. Its demand overrides all others in the law of the divine manifestation. At a yet higher reach, supermind, or intermediately principles touched by it, or still higher, a pure bliss, a pure conscious power, or pure being, replace mind as the dominant principle, and we enter into those ranges of cosmic existence which to the old Vedic seers were the worlds of illuminated divine existence and the foundation of what they termed immortality, and which later Indian religions, imaged in figures like the Brahma Loka or Goloka, some supreme self-expression of the being as spirit, in which the soul, liberated into its highest perfection, possesses the infinity and beatitude of the eternal Godhead. So some part of this was added by Sri Aurobindo. Right after the term supermind, he describes, or intermediately, principles touched by it, which he will come to describe in chapters not far from us now, or still higher, a pure bliss, so showing that the range of this ascending series climbs into what we would call the divine planes, into the realms of divine existence, divine conscious power, divine bliss, leading to the supramental as they descend, and leading up from the supramental back to the heights of that triplicity as we ascend. So we see this picture now of substance figuring itself in matter according to certain laws which describe the relationship of conscious force to being at that level, replicated in the life plane, but in terms appropriate to life, replicated in the plane of mind, but in terms appropriate to mind, and thus leading beyond. Always this interplay, consciousness, force of consciousness, dealing with its own substantial being, not playing an utter hide and seek, because we can see that these things are all connected. In fact, they interplay at every level. But the basis of the cosmos is materiality. So that is the starting point of the whole evolution. And now he continues. The principle which underlines this continually ascending experience and vision, uplifted beyond the material formulation of things, is that all cosmic existence is a complex harmony. A harmony, many notes, many chords, fashioned into a pleasing shape. But harmony comes from Greek. Sri Aurobindo knew Greek thoroughly. Harmonia, from harmos, which means a joint fitting. So joints in architecture, wooden or stone, fitting into each other, which lead to the raising of a colossal building. There is an architectural connotation that comes with the original idea of a harmony, which is shared with the field of music, taken into the field of music. So let's continue with that sentence again. The principle which underlies this continually ascending experience and vision, uplifted beyond the material formulation of things, is that all cosmic existence is a complex harmony and does not finish with the limited range of consciousness in which the ordinary human mind and life are content to be imprisoned. Being, consciousness, force, substance descend and ascend a many-runged ladder, on each step of which being has a vaster self-extension, consciousness a wider sense of its own range and largeness and joy, force a greater intensity and a more rapid and blissful capacity. Substance gives a more subtle, plastic, buoyant, and flexible rendering of its primal reality. So we see the nature of this Satchitananda thrown out into demonstration. In other words, made manifest at each of these levels, interpenetrating levels. For the more subtle is also the more powerful. One might say, the more truly concrete. It is less bound than the gross. It has a greater permanence in its being, along with a greater potentiality, plasticity, and range in its becoming. Each plateau of the hill of being gives to our widening experience a higher plane of our consciousness and a richer world for our existence. So as we climb, we gain in freedom. We gain in vista. What is potential to us at one realm is outstripped by the potency of the following. Where we feel rigid and crimped in the material form of matter's housing, we feel limitless when we reach the higher stage. So our experience becomes greater and greater. But now, however it might be experienced in those higher planes, what does it mean for the body? And he comes back to this now. But how does this ascending series affect the possibilities of our material existence? It would not affect them at all if each plane of consciousness, each world of existence, each grade of substance, each degree of cosmic force were cut off entirely from that which precedes and that which follows it. But the opposite is the truth. So these are not demarcations. There are fluid lines in which matter seeds to life, seeds to mind, seeds to supermind, and on we go upwards. The opposite is the truth. The manifestation of the spirit is a complex weft, and in the design and pattern of one principle, all the others enter as elements of the spiritual whole. Back to this idea of the complexity of an arrangement. He called it a harmony before, now it's a weft. So the interweaving of elements and materialities. Our material world, he says, is the result of all the others. For the other principles have all descended into matter to create the physical universe. And every particle of what we call matter contains all of them implicit in itself. Their secret action, as we have seen, is involved in every moment of its existence and every movement of its activity. So, in matter is life, is mind, is the undiscovered supermind, is the enormity of Satchit Ananda. And as matter is the last word of the descent, so it is also the first word of the ascent. As the powers of all these planes, worlds, grades, degrees are involved in the material existence, so are they all capable of evolution out of it. So, all from Satchit Ananda down to life are involved in the casement of matter and can therefore evolve out of it, develop out of it. It is for this reason that material being does not begin and end with gases and chemical compounds and physical forces and movements, with nebulae and suns and earths, but evolves life, evolves mind, must evolve eventually supermind and the higher degrees of the spiritual existence. Again, back to the hidden purpose, the telos. Implicit in the universe, Satchit Ananda reveals all of itself in evolution. It begins almost entirely oblivious of itself in matter, but must in the end come to the full flowering of all its possibilities. It cannot be thwarted. Evolution comes by the unceasing pressure of the supramaterial planes on the material, compelling it to deliver out of itself their principles and powers which might conceivably otherwise have slept imprisoned in the rigidity of the material formula. This harkens back to earlier paragraphs where he described that the higher laws on other planes of existence could manifest in materiality. He comes back to this idea here. An unceasing pressure of those planes on the material force it to deliver their potencies. They must come out because they're being struck. And he says here, and he revises this a little bit, he says, which might conceivably, he adds the word conceivably here, otherwise have slept imprisoned. And then he adds a complete final sentence. This would even so have been improbable, since their presence there implies a purpose of deliverance. But still, this necessity from below is actually very much aided by a kindred superior pressure. So he asserts then that even if the supra-material planes did not press upon matter, their very presence inside of matter would stir and want to come out through the force of evolution. But there is an intent of these greater planes to press upon and intervene and inject themselves through some force of awakening into matter so that they do stir into life, so that greater powers emerge from that, into mind, so that greater powers and lights emerge in mentality as well. So there's an implied partnership below and above. So the spirit wants to transform the earth, is not disgusted by the apparent denials present in the restricted consciousness of mind, in the limited power of life, in the apparent insentience and blindness of matter. On the contrary, they're forcing their way in. So if this is what the spiritual planes want to do, why do we, wanting to practice spirituality, want to run from the world? I think the reverse is what we're called to do, to fully embrace the world and be spiritual here in matter. I think this is his argument, is it not? He continues, nor can this evolution end with the first meager formulation of life, mind, supermind, spirit, conceded to these higher powers by the reluctant power of matter. For as they evolve, as they awake, as they become more active and avid of their own potentialities, the pressure on them of the superior planes, a pressure involved in the existence and close connection and interdependence of the worlds, must also increase in insistence, power, and effectiveness. So the higher we go, the more power the ranges of spiritual awareness have to force the emergence and spur forward the evolution of this existence, which we call the cosmos. And now he adds another important phrase. Not only must these principles manifest from below in a qualified and restricted emergence, but also from above they must descend in their characteristic power and full possible efflorescence into the material being. The material creature must open to a wider and wider play of their activities in matter. And all that is needed is a fit receptacle, medium, instrument. That is provided for in the body, life, and consciousness of man. So these principles, as he says, must manifest here. But they must manifest here in a way that they can really be who and what they are, not diluted in strength, not stepped down so that they don't make matter shake and quake, but be able to stand fully, radiantly, for what they are above, but here. Certainly, if that body, life, and consciousness were limited to the possibilities of the gross body, which are all that our physical senses and physical mentality accept, there would be a very narrow term for this evolution, and the human being could not hope to accomplish anything essentially greater than his present achievement. But this body, an ancient occult science discovered, is not the whole even of our physical being. This gross density is not all of our substance. The oldest Vedantic knowledge tells us of 5 degrees of our being: the material, the vital, the mental, the ideal, the spiritual or beatific, and to each of these grades of our soul, there corresponds a grade of our substance, a sheath, as it was called in the ancient figurative language. Well, this takes us back to the Taittiriya Upanishad, which opened this chapter. If you remember, there is a self that is of the essence of matter. There is another inner self of life that fills the other. There is another inner self of mind. There is another inner self of truth knowledge. There is another inner self of bliss, which is how he compressed and condensed the longer passages from the Taittiriya to get it into reasonable scope. So this is the Vedantic teaching that he's referring to. And it has reverberated throughout the rest of Indian philosophy and spiritual history. Note, he describes the relationship of the soul and its substance, because this is the relationship of the conscious being with the form, the substance that its being takes to act as the housing of it. They're not different from each other. Substance is not different from soul, but the relationship of soul and substance obtains differently at all levels, and yet all are interconnected, all are one. This is the teaching of the Taittiriya as well. To return to Sri Aurobindo's paragraph, a later psychology found that these 5 sheaths of our substance were the material of 3 bodies, gross, physical, subtle, and causal, in all of which the soul actually and simultaneously dwells, although here and now we are superficially conscious only of the material vehicle. So engrossed in the external world's design, to borrow a phrase from Sri Aurobindo's Savitri, we fail to see the subtle realms. We fail to see those determinative realms above the subtle. And here, in a brief way, he has referred to all of the vast subliminal nature which lies waiting for us to discover. Landscapes which are rich and redolent and could transform our lives just by their very presence, let alone what he calls the causal, which is above in the supramental, which leaning down can transform all, absolutely, down to the very matrix. We are aware only of the brute reality of our body, and in moments when we are challenged, doubt the existence of an assertive life which can last beyond the frame that supports it, or of our mentality which similarly becomes nebulous to our grasp. But, Sri Aurobindo writes, it is possible to become conscious in our other bodies as well. And it is, in fact, the opening up of the veil between them and consequently between our physical, psychical, and ideal personalities, which is the cause of those psychic and occult phenomena that are now beginning to be increasingly, though yet too little and too clumsily examined, even while they are far too much exploited. Well, we must pause for a moment and note that, yes, becoming aware of our bodies, you know, we can leave our physical body behind and live in the subtle body, leave that behind and live in higher and higher and higher iterations. Depending on how you want to subdivide the interior worlds is up to the soul who experiences nature. There are great realms which are classified, as Sri Aurobindo has noted, as five in number, but they can be counted differently. Mother, when she was being taught occultism by the Tions, we'll call them, in France and Algeria, learned of 12 sheaths or encasements and could deliberately go out of them following the example of her primary teacher in that, Madame Tillon. But Sri Aurobindo here is working largely within the Indian context, so let's return to that. He continues, "The old Hatha Yogins and Tantrics of India had long ago reduced this matter of the higher human life and body to a science. They had discovered 6 nervous centers of life in the dense body, corresponding to 6 centers of life and mind faculty in the subtle. And they had found out subtle physical exercises by which these centers, now closed, could be opened up. The higher psychical life proper to our subtle existence, entered into by man, and even the physical and vital obstructions to the experience of the ideal and spiritual being could be destroyed." Well, I read that poorly, I apologize. But this is a summary of the tantric philosophy available to Sri Aurobindo at the time of this writing. Later, Sri Aurobindo would hear about the Trika philosophy of Kashmir. It is unclear that he ever saw any material of that, but material would be very relevant to his purview, because there too there is the idea of the transformative power of the spiritual consciousness. And one of the founders of that system, Goraksha, who is also thought to be the founder of Hatha Yoga and a great example of tantric fulfillment, counted not 6, but 9 powers, centers of awareness, the chakras of existence. They were later condensed to 6, some more subsumable to others, but that there are ranges of being in which we can dwell and find substantial encasement so that we can work and operate in them according to the laws of that world, is something we can each experience as we grow yogically and become aware inwardly of these worlds. This is not fantasy. This is the substance of real experience, something that can be grounded. Again, some of this material has been slightly retouched by Sri Aurobindo here. The final sentence of this paragraph is, "It is significant that one prominent result claimed by the Hatha Yogins for their practices and verified in many respects was a control of the physical life force, which liberated them from some of the ordinary habits or so-called laws thought by physical science to be inseparable from life in the body." And these, of course, are the various siddhis, the Ashta Siddhi, the 8 cities, the 8 fulfillments, which give the person who has gained that power the ability to suspend or subordinate physical laws according to his will. And this indeed was suggested to be one of the most striking things about the personality of Goraksha, that he wielded such powers. Behind all these terms of ancient psychophysical science lies the one great fact and law of our being, that whatever be its temporary poise of form, consciousness, power in this material evolution, there must be behind it, and there is, a greater, a truer existence of which this is only the external result and physically sensible aspect. Now, this is, of course, Sri Aurobindo's experience. And again, he's writing from something he has realized. This is not a thought. This is not a notion. Our substance, he says, does not end with the physical body. That is only the earthly pedestal, the terrestrial base, the material starting point. As there are behind our waking mentality, vaster ranges of consciousness, subconscient and superconscient to it, of which we become sometimes abnormally aware. So there are, behind our gross physical being, other and subtler grades of substance, with a finer law and a greater power, which support the denser body, and which can, by our entering into the ranges of consciousness belonging to them, be made to impose that law and power on our dense matter, and substitute their purer, higher, intenser conditions of being for the grossness and limitation of our present physical life and impulses and habits. So again, this relationship between ranges of consciousness and the capacity to transfer them into substance of being. If that be so, he says, then the evolution of a nobler physical existence, not limited by the ordinary conditions of animal birth and life and death, of difficult alimentation and facility of disorder and disease, and subjection to poor and unsatisfied vital cravings, ceases to have the appearance of a dream and chimera, and becomes a possibility founded upon a rational and philosophic truth which is in accordance with all the rest that we have hitherto known, experienced, or been able to think out about the overt and secret truth of our existence. This idea to evolve a nobler physical existence, something that is akin to the stature of the spiritual being which wishes to inhabit it. This is the aim of his yoga. This is the aim of his vision. This is the kind of partnership between spirit and matter that should obtain in this world. I'm reminded of something Amal Kiran shared when he was permitted to come into the rooms of the mother and take a nap to improve his physical health. He noted that if he lie in a certain condition on the sofa, that when Sri Aurobindo would enter from one room to another, he couldn't see Sri Aurobindo, but he could see his shadow cast by the sun against the wall. And he said it was thrilling, because even in his privacy, Sri Aurobindo stood with such a majesty that he looked the very embodiment of the Supreme. And Amal melted at the very sight. But he wondered if indeed he should be witnessing this. So he mentioned to Mother, confessionally, that when he took his rest there, that he saw this. He said, "Should I discontinue?" And she said, "Yes, it would be better if you discontinue." Sri Aurobindo wanted to be seen only on certain days of the year, so that He could draw that force down from above and condense it into his body, constellate it in his own physical being. And any detraction or note of dissonance that could disturb or perturb that movement would be unwelcome, not simply to him, but to all the universe, which is waiting for this convergence to occur. So pardon me for taking you there. So it should rationally be. For the uninterrupted series of the principles of our being and their close mutual connection is too evident for it to be possible that one of them should be condemned and cut off while the others are capable of a divine liberation. The ascent of man from the physical to the supramental must open out the possibility of a corresponding ascent in the grades of substance to that ideal or causal body which is proper to our supramental being. And the conquest of the lower principles by supermind and its liberation of them into a divine life and a divine mentality must also render possible a conquest of our physical limitations by the power and principle of supramental substance. It must be capable of being exported from there down here. If laws from above can penetrate the lower encasements, then the supramental power must, with its supramental substance, be capable of penetrating materiality here. Our ascent to that, note what he says, which is proper to our supramental being. Not one of us here is absent that supramentality. Only it remains in its essence undiscovered by us. It is always our secret nature. And we must have the power inherent within us to rejoin it, become it, and install it here. And powers there are from above that want to aid us in that. And this means the evolution not only of an untrammeled consciousness, a mind and sense, not shut up in the walls of the physical ego or limited to the poor basis of knowledge given by the physical organs of sense, but a life power liberated more and more from its mortal limitations, a physical life fit for a divine inhabitant, and in the sense not of attachment or of restriction to our present corporeal frame, but an exceeding of the law of the physical body, the conquest of death, and earthly immortality. For from the divine bliss, the original delight of existence, the Lord of immortality comes pouring the wine of that bliss, the mystic soma, into these jars of mentalized living matter. Eternal and beautiful, he enters into these sheaths of substance for the integral transformation of the being and nature. A remarkable passage. This was added to the original essay from the Aria. And if you remember, I described how he had added and substituted citations from the Upanishad and from the Rig Veda, retranslated one section. He has taken some of that and installed it into this beautiful imagery here. The Lord of immortality comes pouring the wine of that bliss, the mystic soma, into these jars of mentalized living matter, the matter, life, and mind, the vehicle that we have, so that is imported and poured into us. Eternal and beautiful, He, the Supreme, enters into these sheaths of substance to transform integrally all that we are. So he's back to that opening citation. The laws of nature, the laws of the body, can be changed. What we think are the hard laws of physics are subject to change by the will force that proceeds from the divine conscious being. What is concealed in us can step out. The inner truth can manifest. Just as life emerged from matter and mind emerged from life, the divine being, consciousness, bliss, the harmonic being of the supramental can manifest in us and must. This is the end of this chapter. And if you will, I think I'll continue reading from where we left off in Savitri last time. This again is from Book 2, The Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, Canto 1, The World Stare. This was the single stair to being's goal. A summary of the stages of the spirit, its copy of the cosmic hierarchies, refashioned in our secret air of self, a subtle pattern of the universe. It is within, below, without, above. Acting upon this visible nature scheme, it wakens our earth matter's heavy doze to think and feel and to react to joy. It models in us our diviner parts, lifts mortal mind into a greater air, makes yearn this life of flesh to intangible aims, links the body's death with immortality's call. Out of the swoon of the inconscience, it labors towards a superconscient light. If earth were all, and this were not in her, thought could not be, nor life delight's response. Only material forms could then be her guests, driven by an inanimate world force. Earth, by this golden superfluity, bore thinking man, and more than man shall bear. This higher scheme of being is our cause, and holds the key to our ascending fate. It calls out of our dense mortality, the conscious spirit nursed in matter's house. The living symbol of these conscious planes, its influences and godheads of the unseen, its unthought logic of reality's acts, arisen from the unspoken truth in things, have fixed our inner life's slow-scaled degrees. Its steps are paces of the soul's return from the deep adventure of material birth, a ladder of delivering ascent, and rungs that nature climbs to deity. Next week, the sevenfold cord of being. Namaste. Jai Ma.